This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Tonight we have a wonderful lecture for you. Dr. Gary Small is always a lecturer that brings a lot of people, so I'm thrilled to have you all here tonight. Dr. Gary Small is a professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences and the Parlow Solomon Professor on Aging at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, director of the UCLA Longevity Center, and director of the Geriatric Psychiatry Division at the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior. Dr. Small's team has developed brain imaging technologies that detect the first signs of brain aging and Alzheimer's disease years before patients show symptoms. His discoveries have made headlines in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and he frequently appears on the Today Show. He has newest book called The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, where he shares the latest scientific evidence on Alzheimer's prevention and a daily lifestyle strategy designed to delay the onset of Alzheimer's symptoms so people can keep their brains healthy through the rest of their lives. And that's what he plans to speak on tonight. So please welcome Dr. Gary Small.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and I want to thank my mother for writing it. She's very kind to me. And I want to thank all of you for coming out this evening to hear what I have to say. I'm just curious, by a show of hands, how many of you heard about this lecture through the university, on email, and so forth? Okay. How many of you heard about it on the radio yesterday? Okay. How many of you can't remember where you heard of it? So we either have one person with a sense of humor or who's very honest. Very good. Now, you think you've got problems. I'm supposed to be a memory expert. I mean, it's daunting. And we're going to talk about some of these mild age-related memory complaints that are annoying. And we'll talk about it when they become worse than annoying, when they really interfere with our lives, and how do we know the difference and so forth, and what we can do about it. So I'm going to move on to the first slide and acknowledge some of the wonderful support we've had for the research I'm going to be showing you, and also thank some of my many colleagues who have helped me out, also acknowledge some potential conflicts of interest. And move right on to the first point I wanted to make about healthy aging. I direct the UCLA Longevity Center, and we think about this a lot, how we can live better longer. And when we talk about Alzheimer's prevention and brain health, the topic of successful aging often comes up, and it's quite interesting. And you might have heard about clusters of centenarians, people who live to 100 or more, and how there are areas of the world where they seem to be clustering. And I have on this slide just a few examples of them. Sardinia, Italy. Loma Linda, California, not far from here. And another one, Okinawa, Japan. And if you look at these different areas, it's quite interesting. The people share some traits, some lifestyle traits. They tend to be physically active. They're working in the fields. They also have very strong social networks. They tend to sit around, sip their cappuccino, drink a glass of wine, and talk about things. And they also have diets that are rich in antioxidant fruits and vegetables, whole grains, healthy proteins, the kind of diet we know is a heart-healthy diet, but it turns out it's also a brain-healthy diet. Now, this doesn't prove that if you get up and decide to move to Sardinia, Italy, that you're going to live to be 100. But it is a clue that maybe there's a connection here. Now, it's possible also these people have very good genes. There have been some scientists, particularly at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, that have been looking at families that live a very long time, and they've found some longevity genes. And there's in most of these studies, usually there's a genetic and environmental interaction. But there are other examples of extreme longevity, healthy brain longevity. If you can still subtract, you can figure out that Madame Calmont lived to be 122. And she did not have Alzheimer's disease when she died. She had a healthy brain. And she, too, was physically active. She drove her bicycle around town. She lived in the south of France. Anybody here from has visited the south of France? And so you know the Mediterranean diet, lots of fish and with its omega-3 fats and fruits and vegetables and a little bit of wine. It's good for your heart. It's also good for your brain. And she was mentally active, too. In fact, she was an astute businesswoman. At the age of, so she lived to be 122. At the age of 94, she sold her apartment to a French businessman who agreed to pay her rent for the rest of her life. The real punchline is that the businessman died 10 years later. So you've all heard of the Ponzi scheme. I call this the Calmont scheme of successful aging. Now, we're going to be talking about Alzheimer's and what we can do to hopefully stave off the symptoms. But the flip side of Alzheimer's is brain health. And many people equate brain health with having a strong memory. But as this slide shows, brain health is not just about memory. Now, clearly, memory is important. It defines who we are. Without our memory, we have no past. We cannot plan for the future. And we can't enjoy the present. But if you think about it, brain health also involves paying attention. If you can't focus your attention, you can't remember anything. And it involves thinking and reasoning, putting things together. And that depends on attention and memory. And mood. If you're anxious or depressed, you can't focus your attention. You can't think clearly, and you can't remember things. And of course, you have to learn to relax. And physical activity depends on our brain health. If I didn't have my brain health, I wouldn't be here lecturing to you today. I wouldn't be able to talk. I wouldn't be able to move my arms. And what's interesting is we need our brain health to make the right decisions about lifestyle, about diet, about exercise, the kinds of things we need to do to maintain our brain health. So it's sort of a cycle. If you've got your brain health, then you're going to do the right things to maintain it. Now, if you get a chance to take a look at my book, The Alzheimer's Prevention Program, and we were hoping to have books here, but I think somebody forgot. So they obviously didn't read the books. But we'll figure out a way. I mean, there are ways to get books, even if they're not, if you're not here. And I'll direct you to places. Maybe they'll get some books here. That would be nice. But in the book, I talk about inflammation and brain health. And that's kind of a theme. We all know about inflammation being a normal physiological process. If you sprain your ankle or your wrist, or if you have an infection, your inflammatory system deals with it. Those inflammatory cells will repair the damaged tissue. They will fight off the foreign body. And that's a good thing. You may feel some pain. You may have some redness on the joint. But that means your body is healing. One of the problems we see with brain aging, and actually a lot of age-related illnesses, is that the inflammatory system kind of gets into high gear. We have too much inflammation for our own good. And in fact, if you look at an Alzheimer brain, you can see evidence of inflammation. The amyloid plaques I'm going to be talking about. If you're a physician, you'll know about activated microglia or complement. You see that in the amyloid plaque. And I'll show you some of the studies we've done where we've actually used anti-inflammatory drugs to help with memory. And a lot of the strategies in the Alzheimer's prevention lifestyle are anti-inflammatory strategies. Getting a good night's sleep. Eating omega-3 fats from fish or nuts or flaxseed. or physical exercise. These are anti-inflammatory strategies. I know when I've had a brisk swim or a jog or ridden the bicycle, I've gotten my heart pumping, I've had a good cardiovascular workout, I have less joint pain. I feel better. My mood is elevated for other reasons. But this is all your inflammatory system coming into play. Now, it's great to see such a large crowd tonight, and I appreciate your attendance. And I know that part of the reason is that Alzheimer's is on our mind. We hear about it every day. I get Google alerts and all kinds of news articles. There's all kinds of things going on. There's new research that's happening all the time. And frankly, it's confusing. And as a scientist and a physician, it's confusing to me, and I know for the public it's confusing. One day we're saying, take vitamin E. The next day we say, don't take vitamin E. And this was, in part, what motivated us to write this book, to try to take this science and put it in perspective so people could understand it, and take it one step further to create a practical program where people can get themselves started. In fact, in the book we have a one-week jumpstart program where we suggest what people ought to eat. We give them exercises, mental and physical exercises, that build up over the week. And there are assessment tools so they can see their progress. And we think this is important because it's important to get started. If this is a topic that celebrities have taken on. Maria Shriver has crusaded against it because it's affected her family. We have lots of people telling us about their diagnosis, musicians, actors, and of course Ronald Reagan put his face on the disease. One reason many people are declaring their diagnosis and they don't seem to be confused is that we're better at diagnosing it earlier. That's good, but the problem is we need more effective treatments. Another reason we're hearing so much about it is that we're living longer, thanks to medical technology, in part. If you were born at the turn of the 1900, the turn of the last century, you'd be lucky if you lived to be 50. If you're born today, you're going to live to be 80. Age is the single greatest risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease. By age 65 or older, the risk is 10%. By age 85 or older, it can be as high as 40 or 50%, depending on the study. So this is a big problem. We know we have 80 million baby boomers who just a year ago started turning age 65 when they're concerned about what they can do. Every 70 seconds, another American is diagnosed with Alzheimer's dementia. So this is a big public health concern. Well, let's begin by defining what it is. In 1906, Alois Alzheimer presented the first case to the medical community. It was a 51-year-old woman who had psychosis and confusion, so she was out of touch with reality. She had a very aggressive illness. In 4 years, she died. And what he did that was novel was to do an autopsy and apply special stains to the brain tissue. And he found in her brain these amyloid plaques, these little round proteinaceous waxy filamentous deposits, and these elongated tangles, abnormal protein deposits. And they collected in areas of her brain that control brain health, all those functions that I was talking about a moment ago. So this was a big breakthrough, but the medical community assumed this was a rare presenile dementia because the woman was only 51 years of age. Now, years later, pathologists did autopsy studies on older people who had what we then called senility. We used to assume that as people got older, they just became senile, and it was a normal part of aging. When they did those autopsy studies, they found the same plaques and tangles in these older individuals. And so now we had early onset Alzheimer's and late onset Alzheimer's. Now what that also resulted in was an epidemic of Alzheimer's disease, because all of a sudden all these older people weren't just normally senile, they had a disease. That was frightening in part, but it also pushed scientists to begin to look for better diagnostic tools and also for better treatments. Now if you look at a normal brain, you see it's nice and plump, and if you look at an Alzheimer's brain, it's atrophied or shrunken. And here you see these insets show you in the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe these concentrations of plaques and tangles. In fact, they're sort of regional. In the medial temporal lobe, there's more tangles. And in the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe, there's more plaque. But look at the healthy brain. You see an occasional plaque, and you see an occasional tangle. And it turns out that these proteinaceous materials that define the disease start building up in our brains years, even decades, before we have symptoms. And I'll get into some of the evidence for that in just a moment. But let's define a couple of other terms that I'm going to be using. First, memory. Now, memory is a very complex function, but to keep it basic, we can think of two components to memory: learning and recall. So we have to learn the information, get it into our heads, and we have to be able to retrieve it later. I also use the term cognition, which encompasses memory, but other mental functions: attention, thinking, reasoning, visual spatial skills, so the ability to read a map. And then there's the term dementia, which also many people equate with senility. It's basically memory loss, another cognitive impairment, and the impairment is to the degree that it interferes with everyday life. So people with dementia need help from others. And the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. That's where you have the plaques and tangles in the brain. It has a gradual onset and progression. But many different things can cause dementia. You can become demented from having small strokes in your brain. And there the onset might be sudden. Or it could be a sudden onset from a depression. And that can be a treatable, reversible dementia. Or you can be demented from a thyroid imbalance. Medications can cause dementia. One of the first patients I saw with a diagnosis of dementia when I was in my training was taking 10 milligrams of Valium a day. I stopped his Valium and I cured his dementia. So it's important if somebody has a cognitive impairment and it's interfering with their daily life that they see the doctor, because not only can there occasionally be a reversible cause, but even if it's Alzheimer's dementia, there are treatments that can help. So, the most common memory complaints. Anybody want to take a guess if you can remember it? Somebody's got to blurt it out. I can't. Names, that's right. 85% of older people complain about names. And then somebody said words. I'll get to that. Where you put things, memory places, prospective memory. So you leave the house and you forget your cell phone. And then the tip of the tongue phenomenon, where you should know that word. It just doesn't roll off the tip of the tongue. Now, those first two common problems, you can get, there's a lot of places you can get techniques on improving that. The last two, there's not, I couldn't find anything out there on it. And so I was adamant about getting it into this new book. So we have, for the first time, practical techniques that really work for these last two annoying memory complaints. So these are common. Everybody has these problems, and we'll talk about how you can alleviate them. But first I wanted to segue with another example of successful brain aging, my wife's 104-year-old grandmother, Grandma Ollie. And I would like to disclose that at the time that we took this photograph, I was not injecting myself with anabolic steroids. Grandma was very short to begin with. And relevant to that issue was that she did not take estrogen after menopause. And she probably got shorter because she developed osteoporosis and compression fractures. And there have been some studies looking at estrogen as possibly protecting an older woman's brain. And there's mixed results. The latest data suggests that if a woman takes estrogen around perimenopause in midlife, it may be brain protective. But if she takes it later in life, after age 65, at least the Women's Health Initiative found that for certain forms of estrogen, it can actually accelerate cognitive decline. So this is true about many different treatments, a similar phenomenon with anti-inflammatory drugs, that earlier in life that may be helpful, later it may accelerate the problem. There's a tipping point that we don't quite understand. And in fact, in the book, I have a section where I talk about, first I begin with the three most important words in real estate. Everybody knows, right? Location, location, location. In this area, it's timing, 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 because the timing of the intervention is critically important. I think one reason we have not been as successful as perhaps we could be with some of the new drug development with Alzheimer's disease is we've been testing those drugs too late after people have dementia. We should be using them in prevention trials, which is what's starting to happen now. But getting back to Grandma Ollie, she did very well. She lived in an apartment without an elevator, so she was physically active. She was mentally active. She was kind of a feisty woman. If you forgot her birthday, she would let you know about it. And she was very proud. I mean, she was 104, and I knew her risk for dementia was high. Even though she was always pretty good, every time I saw her, I'd always worry about her, and I'd want to do a mental status exam, and she would not let me do it, so I'd have to sneak it in. So I remember this visit. I started off the conversation by saying, "So, Grandma, how old are you now?" And she said, "Shut up." So she passed her mental status exam. She did. Now, she did very well. I kind of mentioned a lot of these things that can cause dementia, but there are many different conditions, vascular dementia, Lewy body disease, frontal temporal dementias, head injury is important. We just did a study looking at NFL retirees, and we used our PET scanning, the chemical I'll talk about in just a moment. And I can't really talk about it because of a press embargo on it, but it'll come out on Tuesday. And it's actually being reported in the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry. So my colleague, Dilip Jesta, who's the editor, unfortunately he just got back from India. He couldn't be here tonight, but he's the director of the Stein Institute, isn't he? But it's in his journal that it's going to be published. And there's a lot of interest in this. But head trauma is not good for the brain, as are many other things. What we find, in fact, if you look at an autopsy series of patients with Alzheimer's disease, you'll see those plaques and tangles. But especially if they're older, you see a lot of other things gone wrong. You see a lot of vascular disease. You see evidence of head trauma. So the brain gets knocked around with age. And a lot of the strategies I'm talking about are helpful regardless of what's happened to our brains as we've aged. Now, genetics are important, but they're not the whole story. There are rare mutations, and I've listed them here, presenilins, APP mutation, that cause the disease. And these occur in families where 50% of the relatives get the disease, usually at a younger age, age 50 or 60. And if you're in a family like this, we call it autosomal dominant inheritance pattern, then genetic counseling may be helpful. But for most people, that's not the case. And we're learning more about the genetics. The biggest breakthrough for the common genetic risk was APOE4 a number of years ago. And we were fortunate. Our group collaborated with Duke University on this, and we were involved in those discoveries. And the bottom line is that 20% of the population has a form of this gene, APOE4, and it increases their risk of Alzheimer's disease. But it's not necessarily meaning that you're going to get it. So we don't recommend it as a predictive test. We use it in our research because it can be helpful in determining who's going to respond or not respond to a certain treatment. But we generally don't recommend people get APOE testing. And there's some newer genes that have been discovered. There's a TREM gene that just was discovered. And I mention that because it's a gene that's linked to immunity and inflammation. So again, it goes along with that inflammatory story. Or actually, it's not inflammatory, the story, but it's a story about inflammation. So we've at UCLA done a fair amount of work with PET scanning, positron emission tomography, and it's basically a simple explanation of a PET scanner. It works like a Geiger counter. So it measures radioactivity. And in these experiments, we inject the patient or volunteer with a radioactively labeled chemical. It goes in the vein, it's taken up by the brain. And in these experiments, we used a chemical marker that we invented at UCLA. George Barrio, myself, several other scientists were involved in this. This chemical marker attaches itself temporarily to the plaques and tangles. So this is the first time that this was ever done. We could see the physical evidence of Alzheimer's disease in living people. And so here's some examples of the scans. Here's an older, normal person. And here's that person 2 years later. And you see there's not much yellow or red in the brain. That means there's not much plaque and tangle. And the person has normal aging. Here's somebody who had a condition called mild cognitive impairment. So their memory was worse, but they were not demented. And you can already begin to see the buildup of the plaques and tangles. And 2 years later, that person had Alzheimer's disease, and look at the difference. The brain is riddled with it. And here's an individual who had Alzheimer's disease when we started the study. An individual died a year later. And Harry Vinters did an autopsy study and stained the brain with immunohistochemistry, so we could see here in the lateral part of the brain, the lateral temporal region, you can see there's a lot of plaques and a few tangles. And in the medial temporal region, there are relatively fewer plaques and more tangles. So we can even pinpoint different regions of the brain, even though this particular marker is not specific for plaques or tangles. There are other chemical markers out there right now. One's just been approved by the FDA that's being commercialized that is thought to label amyloid, but there's even controversy about that. I mean, there's a perception that these compounds are specific just for these proteinaceous deposits. But they can label white matter. They can be relatively nonspecific, so we need to be careful on how we interpret the results. But it's interesting, with this compound, it's called DDNP for the chemical structure. If you look at autopsy studies that have been done on people ranging in age from 20 to 90, people dying of car accidents and so forth, pathologists have tracked the buildup of the plaques and tangles in the brain. And you can see this is the pattern. And when we look at our DDNP marker, and if we plot memory score versus the stain, you can see it's very similar to what you'd expect from autopsy studies. And what's also interesting is as the animation loops around to right about now, these individuals have normal aging. They're not going to get Alzheimer's dementia maybe for 10 or 20 years. So one way to understand what's going on, we have brain health, and there's this decline, depending on our genetic profile, will decline at a certain rate. And there are three critical stages that we can track by neuropsychological testing, by different other sorts of PET imaging, looking at glucose metabolism or accumulation of plaques and tangles. So here's normal aging. If it gets worse, then people develop this mild cognitive impairment where they're compensating more. It takes them longer to function, to do their everyday life, but they're still independent. Now, if that progresses, then they develop dementia where they need help from others. And in fact, people who have mild cognitive impairment have a 10% risk of developing dementia each year. So here's that cognitive decline curve. What we're trying to do in our studies and in our programs and in the Alzheimer prevention program is to help people early on, to try to protect a healthy brain rather than try to repair damage once it sets in. We think this is going to be a better strategy. But even people who already have a diagnosis of dementia, we think we can help them, just not quite as much. And the way we help them is medically, using medicines like the ones you see here. You've seen them advertised on television. They cause temporary improvement, but you can see the slope of decline is equivalent to if somebody were on a placebo. And if you stop the medicine too soon, the patient will decline more rapidly. What we're looking for in the research is to find a disease-modifying drug that alters the slope of decline, and if the patient stops the medicine, there'll be a sustained effect. Haven't found that yet. There's been a lot of studies looking at the amyloid plaques, trying to clear that out of the brain. They have not been successful. Maybe because they're treating people too late. They're starting prevention trials with these drugs. Maybe they'll work. They're looking at anti-tangle drugs. That may work. There's studies looking at drugs developed for medical conditions and even intranasal insulin spray. And there's a connection I'll talk about between Alzheimer's and diabetes. So there may be something to that. They've looked at vaccines, infusions. So far, we don't have a disease-modifying treatment, but we're hoping we will in the near future. Now, we did a study a few years ago that was supported by the NIH where we looked at an anti-inflammatory drug, celecoxib, or the brand name is Celebrex. And we looked at people who had normal aging, on average about 59 or 60, and we either gave them the drug or a placebo, an inactive compound or sugar pill. Treated them for about 18 months, and we found that it improved their cognition and also improved their brain function. We looked at glucose metabolism with PET scanning. We saw there was better metabolism in the front part of the brain. But we weren't quite sure how that worked. It could be that the drug did something directly to the brain, or it could have been indirect. In fact, when we started the study, I remember there was a gentleman who was enrolled, and this is before we broke the double blind, and he said, you know, doc, I don't know if this medicine is helping my memory, but I can sure go up the stairs faster. And I thought, well, maybe that's the explanation. People were taking these medicines, they were walking more, they had less joint pain. And we'll talk about physical exercise as having a similar kind of effect. In fact, so this is what I'd like to be doing when I'm 90. But I probably won't be doing it because I've never pole vaulted in my life. So I don't think I have the pole vaulting gene. But that doesn't bother me because we know from the MacArthur study of successful aging and other studies that for the average individual, when it comes to cognitive and physical success as we age, about a third of that is determined by our genetics. That means that two-thirds has to do with non-genetic factors, and we're learning more and more about these factors. And I'm going to focus on these four major areas: physical exercise, mental exercise, nutrition, and stress management. And I like to start with physical exercise because we have the most compelling scientific evidence with physical exercise. A recent study found that if you walk briskly 20 minutes a day, it will lower your risk for Alzheimer's disease. If you can't walk, swim. If you can't swim, move your arms around. Do whatever you can to get your heart to pump oxygen and nutrients to your brain cells. Your body will secrete something called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which stimulates your neurons to grow dendrites or connections between your brain cells. So your brain cells will actually communicate more effectively. In fact, you'll have a bigger brain, and a bigger brain is a better brain. So if somebody calls you a fathead, it's a compliment. So physical exercise is very important. Arthur Kramer at the University of Illinois has taken older adults, put them on walking programs, compared them to similar groups who just do stretching and toning. He finds better brain function, larger brain areas, and better cognitive results. What about mental exercise? There, the evidence is not quite as compelling. We have a lot of studies showing an association, so epidemiological studies showing that if you get a college education, you have a lower risk for getting Alzheimer's disease. Now, we know that's true about UCLA. We're still tallying the results for USC. But I'm protected there because I was an undergrad at UCLA and I went to med school at USC. But in all seriousness, even if you didn't go to college, there's some recent data showing that lifelong learning will protect your brain. So we often encourage people to remain stimulated, to learn, to educate themselves, to try new things, but to train and not strain their brains. If you don't like learning languages, don't bother with that. Do something else that you enjoy. But it's not a guarantee. I mean, you can do lots of crossword puzzles. You'll get better at crossword puzzles, but it's not going to guarantee you that you won't get Alzheimer's. Now, I will show you some data on how much we can stimulate our neural circuits from simple exercises, just searching online. So it is possible that it does something, but it's not a guarantee. Now, on the other hand, if you exercise your brain with focused memory techniques and you're not demented, you will improve your memory. In fact, we've studied this. Other groups have studied it in large multi-center studies. You can improve your memory performance right away, and you can have sustained effects. They've studied it for up to 5 years, but I suspect for even longer. And so in the Alzheimer's prevention program, we combine the physical and the nutritional strategies along with these sorts of methods to compensate for the normal memory losses we all experience. But one thing that is contributing to our memory loss, I mentioned that we have to pay attention, is we're distracted by all these devices. And people are worried, oh, you know, I don't remember all the phone numbers I used to remember. And so my response is, try to turn off your computer once in a while. It's good for your brain. But also, don't worry about remembering the phone numbers. Use your computer as an electrical device to augment your biological memory. And in fact, if we use these computers effectively, we can compensate to a great degree for our memory loss. I remember a few years ago, I'd gotten a new smartphone, and my wife asked me, where are we having dinner? Do you know where the restaurant is tonight? And I said, I'll find it on my phone. So she left the room, came back 10 minutes later. So where's that restaurant? I said, what restaurant? But look at this cool website. So it's not great, especially for aging baby boomers, when you walk into a room and you can't remember why you're there. You know, we really need to kind of put these things down a bit. But I'm, you know, bullish on technology if we use it right. And I think it's challenging as we get older, because older people tend to adopt these technologies slower. You know, we kind of like these sorts of things. And then there's a lot of debate in the media. Is Google making us stupid? And I want to point out, anybody who's a digital native in the room, that stupid is misspelled. Okay? And so we at UCLA wanted to find out, is Google making us smart? So we decided to do a study, and I was curious to see what the brain looked like the first time it searched online. I wanted to see this. And in order to do this study, I had to recruit people who had never searched online. And I very quickly learned I couldn't recruit them online. This was something. So eventually I found people like this. Congratulations, you're the last person on earth to get an email account. That's probably the hardest part of the study. So we found these people. They were on average 65 years of age. We matched them up with a group, same age, that had a lot of internet experience. And we put them in the MRI scanner, and we use functional MRI. So we can alter the sequence of the MRI scanner so we can see brain blood flow from moment to moment and see where the brain is working when we present people or research subjects with a mental task. And so in this experiment, they wore these special goggles, and in the goggles we project images like a book page, and we say, read the book, we're going to test you later. And then we had these internet search sites, and they had a little clicker that operated like a mouse so they could search online. And this is what we found in this study. Here we have the internet-naive people reading the book page, and you can see there's activity in the visual part of the brain, language areas, decision-making areas. So that's what you'd expect from reading. And so the first time these people searched online, I was all excited and I didn't see anything that was different. Very disappointing. And then we looked at the internet-savvy people reading the book page in the same pattern. But the big difference was here. When the internet-savvy people searched online, there was a twofold increase in activity. It's quite interesting. So here's your brain on a book, and here's your brain on Google. And part two of the experiment, we took those internet-naive people, and we had them search online for an hour a day for a week, and we found significant increases in their neural activation after just a week of practice. And it was primarily in the frontal lobe, areas that control decision-making and what we call working memory, very short-term memory, the kind of memory you use when you call directory assistance and you get a number and you dial it, what you used to do, And then the memory goes away of that number. So what we think happens is when we're presented with an unfamiliar mental task, our brain doesn't quite know what to do, and there's random activity. Once we figure out a strategy, there's a surge in neural activity, and once we get good at it, we see less activity. So our brains become efficient. It's very similar to a physical fitness model. And there's a lot of games and puzzles out there to help keep our brains fit and so forth, and a lot of them have not been tested. We've tested some of them. We have a brain boot camp at UCLA. We have a memory training program that we've licensed. It's now in 14 states, in 50 different sites. And people will learn these techniques. Thousands of people take these courses, learn these methods. We did one study with Erickson Living communities, and we found after 6 weeks that there were significant improvements. We did another 2-week program, and here with the PET scan, we saw that brain efficiency in addition to the improvement in memory. So people can improve very quickly with these programs, and it's very gratifying. And in individuals, you see results like this. So this is a woman who we put in the functional MRI scanner. Instead of searching online, we gave her a memory task. And at baseline, she was about 46. She was relatively young, but she was complaining about her memory. And her brain was working really hard to remember the words. We put her on a 2-week program, very similar to the program in the Alzheimer prevention program. 2 weeks later, not a lot of activity, and her memory scores, her verbal memory, improved dramatically. So it was highly significant improvements. And we teach simple techniques. We make it user-friendly, things like look, snap, connect. So look is a reminder to focus your attention. The biggest reason we don't remember is we're distracted. We're not focusing attention. Snap is a reminder to create mental snapshots. Our brains are hardwired to remember visually. And connect is a reminder to link up those mental snapshots so they have meaning. If something is meaningful, it will be memorable. So at UCLA, there's a lot 3B. And when I park in lot 3B, I see three large bumblebees hovering over my car. If I park just below it in lot 2B, I see William Shakespeare standing on my car reciting, "To be or not to be." It's very effective. You may not want to share all your stories with your friends, but trust me, it really works. Now, who remembers her name?
Ollie.
Very good. Now, you remembered it because I showed her name, I emphasized her name, so you rehearsed it. That's important for memory. But if I had glossed over it, you might have said that was Grandma, because Grandma was part of the story. It had meaning. But you can give her face meaning by perhaps looking at her eyes and thinking, oh, she has olive-shaped eyes, olive Ollie. Or here's Paul Foreman. Paul Foreman has a prominent forehead. Or Harry has a lot of hair. And Lisa has a Mona Lisa smile. And you can infuse qualities about the individual into your memories. Sue Bangle is an attorney with bangs, and she's an attorney, so she could sue you. Now, that is memorable because it's an emotional memory, okay, if you've ever been sued. Now, while you're stressing out about your last lawsuit, let's talk about stress. Animal studies show that chronically stressed animals have smaller hippocampal memory centers. Human studies that show that chronic stress can lead to depression, which can increase the risk for dementia. People prone to stress have a 2-fold increased risk for dementia. And humans injected with cortisol, a stress hormone, have temporary memory impairment. Now, it's temporary, which is good, and it means that we can do things to reduce stress. We can't eliminate it, but we can manage it better. We can spend time with friends. We can talk about our feelings. And in fact, being social is critically important. We cite some of the newer studies in the book about how just a 10-minute stimulating conversation is better for your brain health than watching 10 minutes of a Seinfeld rerun. I would have liked to have volunteered for that study because I like Seinfeld. And I like to talk about the triple threat to Alzheimer's disease, and that's taking a walk with a friend every day. So you're going to take a walk, you're going to get that cardiovascular conditioning that protects your brain. You're going to talk about your day. That conversation will stimulate your neural circuits, having the conversation. And finally, if you talk about your feelings, you're going to reduce your stress level, put things into perspective. And you can try other things like Tai Chi, yoga, meditation. In our division at UCLA, some of our investigators, Helen Lavretsky and others, have studied Tai Chi and meditation. They find alterations in neural activity as a result of these exercises, and also find, in addition to improvement in cognition and mood, changes in inflammatory markers in the blood. So again, that theme, inflammation. And finally, it's good to take breaks and to relax. Nutrition is related to brain health. One of the first points is trying to achieve our optimal body weight. We have an epidemic of obesity and overweight worldwide, and we know that those conditions increase the risk for Alzheimer's. Eating omega-3 fats from fish and nuts is anti-inflammatory and good for brain health, as well as eating antioxidant fruits and vegetables, which help to protect the brain from oxidative stress associated with aging. And then finally, trying to minimize refined sugars and processed foods, which are not good for brain health. So obesity and overweight increase the risk for Alzheimer's. The good news is recent studies have found that losing weight actually improves memory performance. One study of obese individuals who underwent bariatric surgery found that after 12 weeks, not only did they lose significant amounts of weight, but they also had significant improvement in cognitive performance. Now, it's easy for me to say lose weight. It's hard to do it. There's been some recent neuroscientific investigations of that, and they've actually pinpointed some of the brain regions that are involved in this process. So if you're successful, if I'm successful in avoiding this beautiful piece of chocolate cake, it's my dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex that's telling me, Gary, don't eat that cake. I know it looks good. Don't eat it. But then there's a part of my brain just above my eyes, the orbital frontal cortex, that's saying, eat the cake. Eat the cake. So it's kind of a battle of the brain that goes on. But what's even more important, when people are successful in dieting, it's hard in the beginning. It gets easier with time. When they check their brains out, there's actually alterations in their neural function. So you actually change your brain as a result of being successful on a diet. There's some other interesting, surprising things about the brain and weight loss. If we have time, we can talk about it during the Q&A period. So while we're on food, let's talk about alcohol and wine in moderation. It's associated with a lower risk for Alzheimer's disease. So people often ask, well how much is a glass of wine? Is it like this? Well, it's more like this. And we're not sure why it is. It may be that people who drink in moderation are just more laid back. Or it could be something in the alcohol. In wine is a chemical called resveratrol. And in animal studies, it has anti-aging effects. So scientists have extracted the resveratrol from the wine, but we're not sure it gets into the brain. We're not sure it passes the blood-brain barrier. So anybody here who's taking resveratrol capsules, make sure you wash them down with a nice Bordeaux, just to be safe. And moderation is the key here, and it's true about caffeine and coffee. In moderation, it's associated with a lower risk for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. Now, there's a lot out there about supplements, and there's a lot we know and we don't know. In fact, the new book has a whole section on supplements. One of the problems is they're not all tested in a double-blind fashion. We're testing them at UCLA. We have a study on curcumin. Curcumin is in turmeric and in curry foods in India. There's a lower rate of Alzheimer's disease than in the U.S. But more importantly, our scientists have found that curcumin is both anti-inflammatory and attacks those amyloid plaques in the laboratory. So we're doing an 18-month double-blind study. We're also looking at pomegranate extract. We did a short-term study, and we found that people who drank 8 ounces of pomegranate juice a day for a month had better memory. But we're not sure. It was a small study, so we're doing now a one-year study using the extracts. Now, other things to think about, I mentioned avoiding head trauma is important. If you smoke, try to quit. try to keep a positive outlook. And simple things like treating hypertension or high cholesterol not only protects brain health, but it also helps people live longer. So can we really prevent Alzheimer's disease? If we think about prevention as being equivalent to a cure, then the answer is no. But the way I think about prevention, I think of it in a more modest way of delaying the onset of symptoms. And I think in that case, there is compelling evidence that we can do something to stave off symptoms. So a way to look at it is here. If we have a decline curve for one individual where that person may become demented at this point, here's non-dementia and dementia, if we can get that person on a program that delays those symptoms for this amount of time, they may have a year and a half or so of dementia-free life. And if that person dies of natural causes before then, we've prevented the disease. And that's the goal that we're looking for. To definitively prove that we can prevent Alzheimer's disease, it would take a Framingham-like study. It would take 10 to 20 years. And frankly, I don't want to wait 10 or 20 years for someone to tell me, by the way, you should have been exercising and eating right. Because I know if we do those things, we start feeling better. It will help us with other health issues. And another argument that this is effective is two of the key Alzheimer prevention strategies, exercise and diet, we already know that that will prevent diabetes. And the latest large-scale studies tell us that if people develop diabetes, that doubles the probability they'll develop Alzheimer's disease. So we're really talking about a lifestyle that bolsters brain health, protects our brain cells, and we add to that cognitive techniques that compensate for the natural decline that everybody experiences. And in the book, we talk about the science. We make it clear, thanks to my wife being my co-author. She, if it were up to me, the book would be organized introduction, methods, results, and discussion. But she's able to make it accessible to a wide audience. And you know, you can look at it in terms of an individual. Here's a hypothetical person who comes to my office, a busy 62-year-old executive, has a terrible diet, doesn't exercise. I talk him into exercising. So he starts walking every day for 30 minutes with his friend. If he maintained a sedentary lifestyle, according to his genetic risk, he might get dementia by age 72. Now, the studies tell us if he keeps up his physical exercise, he may forestall those symptoms by almost 2 years. So he's getting excited. He's feeling better. He's walking with a friend. So he's lowering his stress level. He's starting to change his diet. He's doing brain exercises. He's doing crossword puzzles. And I think, to annoy me, he's doing the New York Times Friday puzzle in ink. But, you know, all power to him. If you add it all up, he may forestall symptoms by 4 years. So for many people, this could really make an impact on their lives. But other scientists have looked at it in terms of public health. Barnes and Yaffe at UC San Francisco have estimated about 5 million people with Alzheimer's in the U.S. and 34 million worldwide. And they talked about modifiable risk factors, so changes that I'm talking about that are very similar. Stop smoking, exercise, lose weight, and so forth. They project the effect of just a 25% risk factor reduction would mean 3 million fewer cases in the U.S. and 17 million fewer cases worldwide. So we're talking about personal health and public health. Now, it's easy for me to say, change your habits. But I know human nature. I know I'll get a traffic ticket, and I'll go to traffic school, I'll drive well. But after 6 months, I noticed, my God, I rolled through that stop sign. So we all have a tendency to forget. And so when Gigi and I wrote this book, we wanted to try to help people to change their lifestyle, to really create brain-healthy habits. So the first thing we tried to do was make it clear the connection between brain health and lifestyle. If we see that connection, we're more inclined to follow through. It has meaning. It's memorable. Second, we created this 7-day program. Jumpstart program. Make it easy. Show people how much fun it is. And then finally, give them assessment tools so they can see the results. And in that way, we hope to try to encourage people, motivate them, to really change their lives, because 1 week is not going to make a difference. We're really talking about creating these habits. So let's see how well you did. What's his name?
Paul Foreman.
Paul Foreman. Very good.
Harry.
Can't forget Harry. Sue Bangle. There you go, with the bangs. So, well, you're all memory mavens. Okay, very good. So just to summarize, you know, I think that it's important if somebody has a cognitive problem that's affecting their health to see their doctor, because doctors can help, and the earlier we intervene, the better the outcome. I'm excited about the research that's going on right now that I think that within the next decade or so, we're going to see some better treatments. In the meantime, while we're waiting for science to catch up, there's a lot we all can do right now to feel better, to improve our physical health and our brain health, and possibly stave off future symptoms of Alzheimer's. For more information about the book, drgarysmall.com, drgarysmall.com. For information on our programs at the UCLA Longevity Center, longevity.ucla.edu. Thank you so much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.